So good afternoon. Again, my name is Brian Paul. I'm a partner at Ice Miller and the president of the Indianapolis Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. Today we're here to debate the constitutionality of the health care reform law, otherwise known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or PPACA. I want to give our speakers as much time as possible to discuss this important issue, and so I'm going to introduce them and promptly remove myself from the podium. Our first speaker will be Thomas Fisher, Indiana's first, only, and current Solicitor General. Tom is presently representing Indiana in a case out of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which recently struck down as unconstitutional PPACA's individual mandate, a provision that requires every American adult either to obtain health insurance or to pay a penalty for failing to do so. That case is now awaiting review from the Supreme Court on a petition for cert. Our second speaker will be Gerard Magliacca, who is Samuel R. Rosen Professor of Law at Indiana University School of Law in Indianapolis. Professor Magliacca has written about PPACA and argued that the individual mandate is constitutional. So here's how this is going to go. Tom is going to give his opening remarks, which will be about 15 minutes long. Gerard will follow with about 15 minutes. Tom will rebut with 5 to 7 minutes, and then Gerard will give his surrebuttal, also 5 to 7 minutes, and then the remaining time will be left for questions. So please welcome our speakers.
Thanks very much, Brian. I'll be sure to speak directly into the microphone. Let me get my watch out here so I don't go too long. Well, I think Brian very generously overstated my role in the state's healthcare challenge. I'm more of a liaison counsel to the big shots that are leading the charge out of the 11th Circuit. We've been able to secure the services of Paul Clement, who is ably representing us before the Supreme Court. And when one has Paul Clement on one side, there's not a whole lot left to do, quite frankly, because he's such an amazing talent. So I've been thinking about the various ramifications of the individual mandate for some time. Even before the Affordable Care Act was finally enacted in its current form, our office was contacted by Senator Lugar, who requested us to study the proposed act at the time, which I think and the main particulars remained the same once it was enacted. And he wanted our view as to impact on Indiana, constitutionality, a whole variety of issues that were implicated by various provisions. That began our office's undertaking to fully understand the act and to come to grips with what it would signify for not only the economy and the provision of health care services, but also the development of the law. So early on, when Greg Zeller and with my assistants started thinking about this, we came to the conclusion that this really represented something brand new in terms of legislative, in terms of congressional action. Not that this was a surprising conclusion, others have reached the same conclusion, but in looking back at all of the things that Congress has done in response to various financial and economic crises in history, we couldn't find any circumstance where Congress had actually mandated that individuals purchase a private product. It just has not happened. And I think this has been borne out throughout all the litigation, even the judges who side with the United States government in defending this act, and they have conceded that much. So the question then is, aside from being novel, doctrinally, what is the problem with the individual mandate, or is there one? Well, if we look back at what Congress has done and what the court has said Congress may do, there are limits. It's not as if the Commerce Clause, which is the cited source of authority for the individual mandate, is a general police power. The Supreme Court has made that quite clear, and they have drawn lines. In the Lopez case, which was in 1995, they said the Gun-Free School Zones Act cannot stand because that exceeds Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. A gun in a school zone is not commerce. Sure, you might aggregate the effects of having guns in school zones and come up with some algorithm that leads you to various conclusions about economic impact. And in fact, Congress did that and the court acknowledged it. But that's not enough, because the gun in the school zone is not commerce. Interestingly enough, in the wake of the Lopez decision, Congress went back and fixed the Commerce Clause problem. They now link it to possessing a gun that has crossed state lines in commerce. So there's actually a jurisdictional hook, and that's important, I think, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Also in recent era, the court has invalidated the Violence Against Women Act insofar as it affords a civil cause of action to victims of violence. And the court in that circumstance said, well, again, if you want to accumulate all of the acts that constitute violence against women, you may ultimately come up with a calculation that leads to interstate economic impact. But that's not enough. Because an act, a particular act of violence against a woman or against a man, because it applies both ways, is not an economic activity that can be regulated. And that ability to aggregate all of that incidental impact is not simply not enough. So we're starting to see then the limits of what the court has said, that you can't simply pile inference upon inference. You can't simply say there is a large incidental aggregate impact. You have to be able to say, is this particular activity something that is economic, something that is, or if it is non-economic, that is critical to what Congress is trying to accomplish. Well, that brings me to the Raich case. The Raich case is an analog to an old case that lawyers learn about in law school called Wickard v. Filburn. And those cases deal with whether Congress may regulate something, essentially a commodity, based solely on the production of the commodity. Not the entrance of the commodity into the chain of commerce, but only on the production of the commodity. In Wickard, it was the production of wheat. The court held Congress may, in fact, limit wheat production. You cannot exceed your quota, otherwise you may disrupt the commodity prices on the market. In Raich, the court said, Congress may, in fact, regulate the growth and consumption of marijuana, even intrastate, even when that marijuana does not cross state lines, precisely because in an effort under the Controlled Substances Act to preclude trafficking in marijuana, it is essential that Congress reach the intrastate marijuana. There's no meaningful distinction between the two. One cannot effectively prohibit possession of marijuana without also reaching the intrastate marijuana. But in all of these circumstances, we have, at the very least, activity. We have, even if it's non-economic, we have some activity that has been connected to the greater chain of commerce, either through an essential connection, as in Raich, or through simply being inherently economic itself, as in Wickard, the idea of growing wheat being on its own sort of the paradigmatic economic activity, agriculture. We also have, looking back at some of the court's most expansive Commerce Clause cases, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the cases that upheld that, the Katzenbach case and the Heart of Atlanta Motels case. Well, those cases are, it's tempting to read them to say, well, there's, you know, not much limit in the way of congressional ability to reach private action. You know, through the Commerce Clause. Well, in fact, those cases actually reviewed statutes that required interstate economic activity. They all presupposed, for starters, that one would already be running a business that would be required to afford public accommodation to all individuals regardless of race. So there was already an entrance into an interstate market. Beyond that, the Civil Rights Act of 64 didn't kick in until there was a baseline interaction in interstate commerce. So Ollie's Barbecue had to purchase so much of its barbecue interstate, or a motel had to treat or host so many travelers traveling interstate before the act actually kicked in. So even beyond the mere entrance into the market, which is distinction enough, there was a required jurisdictional element. Now, we get fast forward to the individual mandate, and we've got a number of distinctions sort of floating around. It's not inherently economic. Is it even activity? There's no interstate component to it inherently. What are we to make of all of this? The focal point of the state's argument has been to draw this line between activity and inactivity. That is a distinction that I think warrants attention based on the text, based on the actual language of the Supreme Court coming out of its Commerce Clause cases, which time and again speaks in terms of regulating activity. I think it's also useful just in terms of understanding what it is that the framers thought they were doing. They understanding the idea of commerce, even as a textual matter, coming out of the idea of the regulation of commerce between the states. This idea of commerce presupposing some kind of commercial intercourse, some kind of activity. It has, I think, a textual link in the inherent meaning of commerce. Now, there are all kinds of arguments against this that we've heard, that it's sort of an artificial distinction. Well, when is something activity? When is it inactivity? Maybe there's some marginal cases where it's hard to sort out between the two. But I think, by and large, it really holds together pretty well. And it certainly affords a useful limit well beyond what we, I think, typically hear from those who favor the individual mandate, who argue in defense of its constitutionality, which is usually the limit that's only occasioned by Congress's political will. The sense that, oh, well, Congress would never make you buy a GM car. We don't worry about that slippery slope. Of course they would never do that. They would never make you eat your broccoli. That's just crazy. That's just crazy. And it becomes, you know, it becomes this idea that as long as we can assume that the political machine will work, that the will of the people, the idea of political accountability is intact, we don't have to worry about falling down the slippery slope too far. Well, that's not really a constitutional standard of any type, and it's certainly not what the court has assumed is the savings of the Commerce Clause in regard to the protection of liberty. The idea, of course, here is that the Commerce Clause, as an enumerated power, is meant to put limits on what the federal government can do on its own. It's not meant to say, well, pause, Congress, before you enact something and consider whether you really want to do this. It is, on its own, supposed to be a limit on authority. So I think it is incumbent upon those who defend the individual mandate to come up with and articulate some limit. If this exercise of authority is within Congress's Commerce Clause power, then what is not? Where else can we see that limit being drawn? There are, I think, various arguments that we've encountered from various sources that are probably worth addressing even now before Mr. Magliocca speaks. Most heartbreaking opinion I've read in years concurring opinion by Jeff Sutton of the Sixth Circuit. Jeff Sutton is a former SG of Ohio, somewhat of a mentor and from a distance for me, somebody I've admired through all these years and continue to admire. He's a very respected judge, a Bush appointee. But he struggled with this inactivity-activity distinction in a recent opinion and ultimately came down on the side of upholding the individual mandate. Well, let me just point out a couple of places where I think Judge Sutton went off course. He spoke about it in terms of what do we do about people who already have insurance? Are we supposed to treat them as inactive? Well, it seems like if you already have insurance, being required to maintain that insurance is simply a regulation of activity because you had the insurance already. You did something. Well, I think that misses exactly the point, which is just because you have insurance doesn't mean that you have to be active in maintaining it. One may do nothing and let one's insurance lapse. That is the inactivity then that is being foreclosed by the individual mandate. It is requiring you to sign up again. So I think the scope or the frame of reference that he was placing on all of this, I think, was inaccurate. He also spoke in terms of wondering about Roscoe Filburn, the farmer from Wickard versus Filburn. Well, if we're talking about this label of inactivity in the context of someone who has not purchased insurance, might Filburn have said, well, gosh, you are forcing me, you're into activity, I am inactive when it comes to the interstate wheat market, now you are forcing me onto the interstate wheat market. And if he could have made that argument, then don't we have to say that that case was wrongly decided in order to prevail here? I think the answer is clearly no. The act in question in Wickard v. Filburn did not require Roscoe Filburn to purchase wheat on the market. It said you may not grow more wheat than your quota. What you do after that is your business. Now, obviously, it created an incentive. Perhaps if he wanted to maintain his cattle, he needed to go buy wheat. But that is not the same thing as actually mandating the purchase. So again, I think the assumption about the act that was in place there and comparing it to the act that we have here is inaccurate. So there are other, I think, concerns that Judge Sutton had about how we can understand this activity-inactivity distinction in a way that suggests that the individual mandate must be unconstitutional. And he put it in terms, I think, that were imaginative, I think creative, I think a little too creative. His concern was, are we supposed, as federal judges, to look at statutes and invalidate them on their face, which is exactly what all these lawsuits ask? You know, these are invalid completely. Are we to do that when we might imagine applications of a statute that could be constitutional? Now, that's certainly the way we go about analyzing statutes when it comes to assertions of individual rights. But it's not the way we analyze statutes when it comes to limitations on congressional power. The Supreme Court in the Lopez case did not ask, well, gosh, we can't. Can we invalidate this Gun-Free School Zones Act when we can imagine circumstances where the gun might have traveled in interstate commerce? They didn't ask that question. They waited for Congress to enact a statute that actually required the gun to travel in interstate commerce. So here, to imagine that there might be circumstances, as Judge Sutton did, where someone is already purchasing insurance or even being made to purchase insurance by their state, and imagine that Congress could regulate that transaction, doesn't mean that you then have to permit the thing to stand and wait for the as-applied challenge. So apparently Judge Sutton, while he would not permit the facial challenge, would permit the as-applied challenge, by whom it's not clear. But he's in struggling with this whole concept of inactivity, he ultimately seems to concede that someone who is truly inactive, that has never purchased insurance, that has never saved money for potential health health risks, maybe that person would be in a position to challenge the individual mandate on an as-applied basis, which doesn't, again, make a whole lot of sense when you look at the actual text of the individual mandate. It doesn't apply only where there is an acceptable jurisdictional hook, an acceptable economic activity at stake. It applies in all circumstances. And the way the court has analyzed challenges, Commerce Clause challenges in the past, that is enough to invalidate the act on its face. And I think that is exactly the situation we're facing with the individual mandate, and the reason I remain hopeful that the Supreme Court will ultimately invalidate it. I'll yield the floor. Thank you.
Is this your phone?
No.
Oh, that's a recorder. I see. Okay. Well, I want to thank Brian and thank Tom for inviting me and for participating in this. I should start with a couple of kind of framing remarks, I suppose. The first is that I'm going to assume, for purposes of discussion, that in fact the challenge to the individual mandate is ripe, because there is an argument that the Fourth Circuit has accepted that in fact the challenge cannot proceed until the individual mandate takes effect, which is 2014. I suppose if we had called this a debate on the Anti-Tax Injunction Act, far fewer of you would have shown up. So we'll push that aside. Second is, I agree with the proposition that this is an unprecedented exercise of Congress's Commerce Clause authority, or alleged Commerce Clause authority, because Congress has never before, under the Commerce Clause, purported to regulate inactivity or compel activity, that is, the purchase of a private product. Okay, but just because it's unprecedented doesn't mean it's unconstitutional. So we need to kind of go further to sort of answer the question. And also, if we uphold the individual mandate, that doesn't mean that Congress has unlimited authority or sort of general police power short of the violation of a constitutional right. Lopez and Morrison are still good law, even if the court upholds the individual mandate. That is, they do state limits on the commerce power. Now, an interesting thing that I've kind of come across in discussing this issue with people over the last year is that there are two different definitions of limited that seem to crop up, right? So one definition of limited, which I think is the one that, say, the more liberal justices, at least some of them might have, would be, well, it's not unlimited. Right, as long as there is a limit somewhere, then it's limited. But I think what others mean by limited is limited in some substantial way or some meaningful way. And perhaps Lopez and Morrison are not meaningful enough, or indeed if you allow something sweeping like this to be upheld, then really the fact that there are other limits somewhere doesn't mean very much for the constitutional design as such. But under at least one way of looking at it, Congress's power would be limited no matter what we do with the individual mandate. Okay, so how do I go about approaching this question? Basically, I want to start by looking at what is the purpose of the enumerated powers concept, right? What does this structural principle in our Constitution do? And really, I think it does two things. First, it is there to protect individual liberty, right? That is, it is designed to, I mean, that was part of the original purpose, that is, the framers said, well, we don't need a Bill of Rights, at least they said this at the beginning, because the federal government's powers are enumerated, and thus they won't be able to invade individual rights. Okay, now later there was compromise that sort of added the Bill of Rights to that, but the idea still applies to how we should think about enumerated powers. Beyond individual liberty, there is the thought that it protects federalism, right? It's designed to leave certain domains to the states by limiting Congress's power. So these are two very important interests that are served by enforcing enumerated powers as appropriate. Okay, now, how do these two interests apply to the individual mandate or to healthcare more generally? Well, the first thing to say is that, of course, there is no individual constitutional right to be free from a compulsory purchase of a private product, in the sense that the state of Indiana could enact such a law, and most people, I think, would conclude that that was constitutional, assuming that the state constitution did not create some kind of barrier. That is, if you take seriously the idea that a state has a general police power, then that means that they could compel you to purchase products. Indeed, Massachusetts, as many of you know, has something similar, right, in RomneyCare. So, now, the fact that there is no individual right to be enforced against Congress or against the states doesn't mean that, therefore, Congress can do it, right? It's not, because, again, we're not saying that enumerated powers means they can do anything that isn't prohibited by a constitutional right. But it is worth remembering, because there is some rhetoric in some of the opinions and some of the briefs that says things that sort of sound like what you're saying is, well, people really ought to have a constitutional right to be free from this sort of compelled purchase. But at least as of yet, this has not been recognized anywhere. Okay, now, what about federalism? Well, when you look at Lopez and Morrison, one way to read them is to say that they are expressing concerns or skepticism about Commerce Clause regulation in areas that have been traditionally regulated by the states. Okay, you see that language in both of those opinions, and indeed you even see it to some extent in the Raich case, at least in Justice Scalia's separate opinion. So let's take Lopez for a moment. Basically, one way to look at Lopez is that, well, one way to look at Lopez is that it involved guns, although at that point gun ownership had not been recognized as an individual right, although now it has been. But more importantly, it was a schools case, right? That is involved regulating things that were going on around schools. And one of the things that the court said, and it was not the only rationale offered, but it said that, look, education has traditionally been something that's been regulated by the states. It's not to say that there's no federal role in education, right? But the bulk of decisions about schools are left to either states or local communities. And that is a well-established practice and one that should make us more concerned when the federal government tries to intrude in that area based on a Commerce Clause claim. In Morrison, that case was, in part, a family law case, right? That is, it was purporting to create a federal civil remedy for domestic violence. And the court again said, well, look, family law is an area that has traditionally been regulated by the states. We don't have federal marriage law for the most part. We don't have federal child custody law, et cetera. Again, not to say there's no federal involvement in family law, but it's much more limited. Both of those areas are ones where the court has sort of marked them out as being domains that should be left to the states to a greater extent than other areas. Now, you could go and look at some of the other Commerce Clause, well, more recent Commerce Clause cases where the court upheld an act of Congress where they took a view that was that this the area in question was not really one that was traditionally regulated by the states. Now, in the Raich case, for example, although I don't think the court's opinion really dealt with this, one could say, well, the federal government had been involved in regulating drugs since at least 1970, in sort of the, when the comprehensive statute was passed by Congress, and that in general it wasn't seen as some one of these sort of special states' rights areas. And indeed, Justice Scalia, in his concurring opinion in Raich, said as much. He said, look, you know, marijuana regulation is not something that I would call a traditional area of state regulation. Now, of course, depends a little bit what you mean by traditional, because, of course, if you go back far enough, you could say that almost everything was left to the states. So I guess maybe what he was saying was during my lifetime, during my career, I mean, I don't know exactly what the boundary was, but at that point it would have been more than 30 years of comprehensive federal regulation in that area. All right, what about healthcare? Right? How does that fit into this? Well, I'm forced to conclude, and I'm not a big fan of the individual mandate, but I have to conclude that healthcare is not an area of traditional state regulation. Why? Because of Medicare. There is a comprehensive federal takeover, basically, of care for those 65 and older that has been in place for more than 40 years. And those are the folks who are sort of disproportionately need health care, right, and also constitutes a large segment of the population. Now, obviously there are other federal regulations of health care, okay, but that's one area where you can say there's this tremendous area of federal intrusion, if you like. Now, the 11th Circuit, in the opinion striking down the individual mandate, actually addressed this in a section. It's a very long opinion, so I mean they said many things, but they actually addressed this, and they were trying to fit their analysis within Lopez and Morrison. And so what they said was, well, yes, healthcare actually is an area that is traditionally regulated by the states. And they quoted from some opinions that more or less mention health as something that's part of the state's traditional police power, and cited a few other things. Unfortunately, they never actually cited Medicare. Right? They sort of wish that away because it undercut what they were trying to say. Now, of course, it isn't necessarily the case that the area in question must be a traditional area of state regulation to be something that is beyond Congress's Commerce Clause power. Okay, so one might concede that healthcare is not an area of traditional state regulation, but nevertheless say, okay, either because of the nature of commerce and or some other arguments, it's still something that we should think of as being beyond what Congress can do. But I'm drawing from what Lopez and Morrison and what Justice Scalia's opinion in Raich talked about, and they all seem to focus on the idea that one of the problems, or lack of a problem, was turned on whether the subject being regulated by Congress was a traditional area of state regulation. And healthcare simply can't, in my opinion, be put in that category. So what I look at from this is, okay, there's no constitutional right to be free from compulsory purchases, and there is no easily recognizable states' rights interest to be free from the individual mandate. That is, in effect, the activity-inactivity distinction really has nothing to do with federalism, particularly. Right, you can imagine intrusive laws that deal with activity that sort of invade the state's prerogatives, or less intrusive laws that deal with inactivity. There's nothing inherently about activity, inactivity that sort of weighs on the federalism question. It is, though, an easy to enforce distinction. I think that's one of the reasons why this argument is going to be a close one when it gets to the Supreme Court. What I come down with is, okay, well, there is sort of a liberty interest involved here, right? I mean, people who don't want to buy health insurance are being made to do so. So that's of concern even if it's not a constitutional interest. And there is sort of a states' rights concern in the sense that you could say, well, we might states, we might want to give states their freedom or autonomy to regulate healthcare or experiment with different things. You know, Massachusetts can try one thing and another state can try something else. And so if we put those two sort of interests together, we get something that is powerful enough to say that Congress's authority does not extend to requiring people to buy health insurance. I guess for me, that's just not enough. I mean, that there isn't any clear, I don't get any clear guidance out of the cases to say that you can sort of mix and match in this way and come up with something that's going to invalidate an act of Congress. Now, that's a doctrinal argument. Let me just, how much time do I have? About
3 minutes.
Okay, good. Let me just close and give you a sort of a hypothetical, which now all of you are familiar with the broccoli eating hypothetical. Most people, I think, who know more about the broccoli part of this discussion than they do about the healthcare part. That, well, if we uphold this, doesn't that mean that Congress can make you buy a GM car, make you buy broccoli? I don't know if they can make you eat broccoli. They can make you buy broccoli, right? I mean, but still, neither of those is very appealing. So I guess here's the hypothetical from the other end, okay, which goes something like this. Suppose there's a serious epidemic and a vaccine is developed by Eli Lilly that would deal with this disease, which is killing a lot of people and seriously impeding commerce in the United States. And Congress decides to require that people be vaccinated because some states are unwilling to require it, or there are people who are unwilling to be vaccinated because they're concerned about side effects, or they're concerned they might contract the disease by taking the vaccination, which obviously is a risk to some extent. Do we really want to say in that sort of circumstance, and we can make it more difficult if I said it was a disease caused by terrorists, or a bioterrorism threat, do we really want to say in those circumstances that Congress lacks the authority to require immunization? Because, well, that's inactivity that you're trying to regulate. Now, one way you could address that or deal with that is to say, well, that's different because the state's interest is greater. It's a threat to national security. It's a very serious health threat. Okay, but then at that point, you're not really enforcing the activity-inactivity distinction anymore. You're just saying, well, if it's inactivity, we have to assess how great the state's interest is before we decide whether Congress has the power to act. And then you have to ask yourself, well, okay, so then really isn't this about just evaluating what you think the state's interest is in providing universal health care to people? And once you're at that level, I mean, I think it's much more difficult to say that that gives you a neat doctrinal way of dealing with these problems, or doesn't essentially put you in a place of evaluating or inserting your own preferences into the analysis of an act of Congress. So we've got there's the broccoli hypothetical, then there's the sort of epidemic hypothetical on the other side. So you got to kind of think about which of those, you know, causes you more concern if you just want to look at it from a sort of consequentialist, practical point of view. So maybe with that, I'll stop then. Let Tom respond.
Well, I guess without thinking about it deeply, just sort of on the spot, my reaction to the hypothetical is that if it were something that was the result of a terrorist attack, we'd probably be implicating powers far beyond the commerce power. We'd probably be providing for the common defense other authority Congress might have. And if we're not talking about a terrorist attack, then I think we're probably, it becomes much more comparable to this situation. But it seems to me that there again, Congress would have to find some basis for regulating the commerce as opposed to regulating the individual. And that probably is a fairly comparable scenario here. So that, I guess, doesn't strike fear in my heart, because it seems to me that Congress would probably, as they could have done here, found, you know, a fair number of commercial transactions to regulate that would lead to the outcome they wanted. Now, I don't think we can get to the limits on congressional authority by thinking about the broad interests that divided and limited government and the commerce authority are meant to protect. I think we have to go to the text. This reminds me in some ways of what Justice Scalia said in Crawford versus Washington, where he rejected the old way of looking at the confrontation clause, the way of looking at it that said, well, as long as you make some effort through hearsay analysis to protect the interests that are protected by the confrontation clause, that's good enough. No, Scalia said. The confrontation clause says you protect the right of confrontation by protecting the right of confrontation. You don't think about the values and see whether they are significantly protected by some other method. You do what the Constitution says. And this is, I think, very similar to that. We don't think about whether there are other ways to protect liberty and federalism or whether they are good, you know, protected well enough under this particular statute. We ask, did the founders provide the authority to do what Congress is doing here? And textually speaking, the answer is no. Now, to the extent that some of the opinions found support in areas such as a concern for typical state operations, fine, that's all well and good. But it certainly is not the critical inquiry that the court relied on, and not, I think, the limit on congressional authority. I think we have to look straight to text, history, and structure, all of which point in the direction that the individual mandate has to be invalidated. This is particularly important regarding what Congress has done in the area of health care. Sure, we've got Medicare, but what is Medicare? Is it an individual mandate? Is it even a use of the Commerce Authority? No. It's taxing and spending. That's the authority for Medicare. What else has Congress done in the area of health care that's particularly notable here? Well, EMTALA, the act that requires hospitals that receive federal funds to treat indigents without pay. That sets up, in many ways, the cost shifting that then becomes the rationale for using the Commerce Authority in this case. Well, can Congress use the spending clause to leverage its Commerce Clause authority? Boy, that seems like a fairly dangerous precedent. All Congress has to do is screw things up with the spending power and then try to rescue it with the Commerce Clause. That's an awfully poor incentive in a constitution that's supposed to have structural limitations. So I don't think that's a ready outlet either. And I do recognize that some of the cases, including Judge Sutton's opinion and also the dissent in the 11th Circuit case, have talked about this liberty interest. They've talked about the idea, well, why are you worried about liberty here? Why is this Commerce Clause supposed to do that heavy lifting? And Judge Sutton, this is one of the areas where it really, I really thought, gosh, he really kind of lost his way. The Bill of Rights is not supposed to be the principal protector of liberty. It's supposed to be the structural limitations. So it makes perfect sense to talk about individual liberty when we talk about the limits on commerce power, even if we don't identify a fundamental right associated with not purchasing insurance. It's a broader concept than that, and it's one that's founded directly in the text of the Commerce Clause and other provisions, other structural provisions of the Constitution. Thanks.
Okay, well, I'll just be brief. I mean, one is, I don't know that we can say from the text of the Commerce Clause whether activity is the only thing that is covered, right? I mean, I can understand an argument that comes from that. I just don't know that it can carry you all the way to your conclusion. So then it's kind of like, okay, if that's not enough, then you have to fall back on what you see out of these opinions. Now, the fact is, look, the opinions in the Commerce Clause area say activity, largely because all of the cases that they were dealing with involved activities. Now, that could presuppose something about inactivity not being included. It's worth noting, though, that nobody really made this argument until after the healthcare statute was enacted, right? If we went back 10 years ago, nobody would have said, well, the Commerce Clause only reaches activity. I mean, it's an argument crafted to meet an unprecedented statute. So it's an unprecedented argument, but it's also an unprecedented statute. So you kind of have to figure out which of those counts for more. I would say also, I certainly agree that it would have been better if they had, that the more sound constitutional approach to getting to universal health care would be through taxing and spending, okay? Now, I guess the question is, but if Congress chose another means, is that unconstitutional? Now, one thing that could speak to this is in McCulloch versus Maryland, as you may remember, right, Chief Justice Marshall said that the choice of the means is for Congress, assuming there's some rational, reasonable basis for it. So if you think of the end as universal health care and the means as, well, do we do it through an individual mandate or do we do it through taxing spending, the fact that Congress chose one mean rather than another would suggest that it has to be upheld so long as you think it's rational, and I don't think anyone really thinks that it's irrational to do what they did, at least in a constitutional context. So I guess that is another way of thinking about the problem and saying that that's why we have to defer to Congress, even if you don't think it's the best approach to the problem that they were trying to deal with. So maybe I'll stop with that and we can take questions.